Energy and American Cultural Values. That report and more next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
The National Humanities Center sponsors several ongoing seminars for its scholars and visitors. One of these is entitled Energy and the Values of Modern Society, a qualitative examination of options in energy and their implications for American social values. A recent visitor to the center's seminar on energy and culture was Harvey Brooks of Harvard University, where Brooks is a professor of technology and public policy. Professor Brooks talks now about the cultural risks and rewards associated with coal, nuclear, and solar energy in a conversation with Sanford Lakoff, a scholar at the National Humanities Center, and with John Agresto, the center's project director. First, John Agresto, then Professors Brooks and Lakoff.
How can nuclear be an option if, in fact, we are talking about catastrophic or potentially catastrophic risk?
Well, it depends on what you define as catastrophic, and that is, in a sense, also a value judgment. If you simply look at the maximum number of fatalities which might result from the largest conceivable nuclear accident and the largest conceivable accident from a dam break, which happens to be the Folsom Dam above Sacramento, the estimate is about 250,000 deaths from the breaking of the Sacramento Dam under the right circumstances, and about 250,000 deaths resulting from the most catastrophic conceivable nuclear accident.
Even in terms of a long-term catastrophe, let's say a contamination of groundwater?
Right, yes. In fact, the deaths from the most catastrophic nuclear accident, the prompt deaths, would be considerably less than the deaths from the dam. And the 250,000 includes all of the drawn-out deaths due to contamination, due to induced cancers, and so on. The number of prompt deaths would be considerably less. Well, different people will evaluate the balance between prompt deaths and delayed deaths differently. People will say, well, I don't mind the dam so much because after people have been killed, you know who's at risk, and you can forget about it. Whereas in the case of the reactor accident, you don't know who's going to die, and in fact, the number of people at risk, as compared with the number of people who are killed, would be very much larger than in the case of the dam accident. In other words, in one case, the risk is over, and you know what fate has decreed, whereas in the case of the nuclear accident, you won't know what fate is decreed for 40 years. And I think that has a very big psychological effect, which different people will evaluate differently. Some people I've talked to say, well, they're not so worried about all these delayed deaths, because after all, the statistical probability of any one person dying of cancer due to a low-level exposure, which is what most of the exposures are, even in an accident, I live with that. It's, after all, less than the risk incurred by smoking. Whereas other people say, but look at all these people at risk who have this sword of Damocles hanging over them for 40 years. And there's a genuine dilemma there.
But aren't we really not talking about the comparison between dams or hydroelectric power and a nuclear power? Really talking about the comparison between nuclear power and coal, isn't that
right?
But coal is
really quite similar. But if you look at coal, then just in terms of number of deaths, the coal will probably produce more on the average. In other words, it's the lumpiness of the deaths, the bunching of the deaths, that makes the nuclear case difficult to compare with the coal case. You have more deaths in total, but they're more lumpy in the nuclear case. So how do you compare the same number of lumpy deaths, let's say, with spread out deaths?
And isn't it also that in the case of nuclear accident, you're talking about a very low probability event,
whereas
in the case of coal, you're talking about a fairly
certainty.
High probability.
Talking about a very virtual certainty.
Well, let's turn that to solar. Is the picture brighter there?
Yes, I think it is. There are no obvious direct hazards associated with solar, except possibly in the case of photovoltaics, solar cells, depending what materials you use in the cells. But most of the hazards associated with solar are what I would call indirect hazards. They are hazards associated, for example, with the production of the materials that go into a solar energy installation. There are hazards associated with the repair or with the construction labor in solar installations, which tend to be labor intensive. And it's very hard to decide what should be included in the system when you talk about solar hazards. In other words, if a large-scale deployment of solar energy resulted in a two- or threefold expansion of the steel industry, which it could conceivably could if we tried to produce all our energy from solar. Well, steel industry is a reasonably hazardous industry, and it creates a lot of pollution. Now, do you ascribe that pollution to the steel industry, or do you ascribe it to solar energy? That's the kind of question that usually arises with respect to solar energy. But the direct, I think it's fair to say that the direct risks associated with solar energy, if you exclude burning wood, are probably much less than they are than almost any other energy form. Actually, if you include the risks involved in producing the steel and materials and construction and so on, then solar energy comes about like coal, or sort of in the same ballpark as coal. But there's a real argument as to whether you should include those risks or not. I accept it would, because of course chainsaw accidents are already a very major source of accidents. But then again, there's a question of whether those are legitimately attributable to burning wood or not. It's a matter of opinion. But that's the kind of difficulty. Again, it's an apples and oranges kind of thing. That's the kind of difficulty you run into in trying to compare different energy forms.
And don't you run into the same difficulty when you move not just from the assessment of risks, but to the assessment of feasibility?
Solar is probably in most applications more expensive than competitive energy forms. And there's been a tendency, even though oil prices and gas prices have been going up, the prices of their competitors seem to go up almost in proportion. We've seen that with synthetic fuels. If you look at the price of solar hot water heaters in Florida, which have been used in Florida for 25 years, they seem to have gone up almost as fast as the cost of fossil fuels. I don't know quite what that means. But my point is, I think the other point I want to make is that it takes time to build up a major industry, even if it's technically feasible. Even if the question of economics of solar were not at issue, if solar were now cheaper than, let's say, a coal-fired electric plant, you have a tremendous job of building up an infrastructure, a whole new industry, a service industry, a distribution industry, people training people, getting consumers knowledgeable about the thing and so on. In my opinion, that would take 20 or 30 years, even if there wasn't a question of economics involved.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, This is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about energy and American cultural values. The participants are John Agresto, Project Director at the National Humanities Center, Harvey Brooks, Professor of Technology and Public Policy at Harvard University, and Sanford Lakoff, a scholar at the center and a professor of political science at the University of California at San Diego. Here's John Agresto.
Mr. Brooks, let me change the direction just slightly. The energy crisis, we've heard said by some commentators, the energy crisis is in a sense a great opportunity for us, a great opportunity to return to a simpler, less hurried, a less technological way of life. Any comments on those observations?
I'm rather skeptical because my experience, nobody ever turns back the clock. One might get some movement in that direction, but the rural utopia that some people speak about, I think, comes up against the following fact of life. That is, if you look at energy consumption in rural and urban areas in the United States, the energy consumption in rural areas is higher than the energy consumption in urban areas. One of the main reasons for that is that rural people require a lot more transportation. Now, if by a simple life you mean an isolated life, so that you can't get to a doctor, so that you can't go to a store to shop and you grow all your own vegetables and so on, it might be conceivable that you could use less energy in the rural life. But I don't think most of the people in the industrialized societies mean that when they talk about returning to a rural life. They really mean living in the country, but being able to go to the city when they want to. Maybe they grow their own vegetables, maybe they heat their house with wood, but they still will probably want a reasonable degree of personal mobility and access to all kinds of modern services such as healthcare, education, culture, and so on, and these all involve the expenditure of energy.
Professor Brooks, you've just been talking in a sense about the values of American culture. You spoke about mobility, access to good medical care, and so on. Do you think that the crisis that we've been facing in energy is not going to in some way change those values or have some transformative effect on those values? Will we still remain the same?
No, I think we'll evolve, but I think one of the characteristics of American values is their increasing diversity. And that, of course, is one of the opportunities that you're talking about. I think on the whole, that's a good thing. Certainly some people may live this kind of rural existence that you're talking about. I happen to be skeptical as to whether the majority of the American people will want to live that way, and especially when there is no real necessity for their living that way.
Let's not call it a rural existence. Let's call it just a less is more existence in urban life itself. Fewer gadgets, less consumption. That needn't be rural.
Yes, you can in fact argue that what we're going to see now is more urban densification in order to minimize the cost of housing, to make it possible to have mass transportation and so on. So realistically, it may be possible to go from a scaling down, a downsizing of America in an urban context rather than simply promoting a kind of rural communitarian utopia.
Yeah, that certainly is a possibility, although it's not one that corresponds with traditional American values, which has always held up the rural life as kind of the utopian ideal. But I think it's quite possible that that's the direction that evolution will go for purely economic reasons. However, I don't see that as being really a simpler life or being something that you can combine with a simpler life. I don't consider the life in a typical European city, which people look up to really as sort of the ideal of urban life, as being any simpler than the life in American cities. Furthermore, the question of gadgets, most of the gadgets that you talk about are really not very important energy consumers, with the exception of the automobile. It's really transportation from the standpoint of the individual consumer, it's really transportation and comfort in the home that are the big consumers of energy. And I can see that the transition to a more urbanized society certainly would reduce transportation energy consumption. But on the other hand, mass transportation, public transportation, is not exactly a harbinger of the simple life.
Mr. Brooks, what should we as a nation be aiming at? Should we be aiming at, let's say, energy independence for ourselves, or energy independence for ourselves and our immediate neighbors, Mexico and Canada? Or should we be aiming at some kind of global interdependence on energy, some kind of world system where, in fact, energy and the products of energy are shared?
Well, I think you have to answer that question in two ways. One would be in terms of preferable, simply personal preference. If you ask me that question as a personal preference, I would opt for interdependence, for global sharing. On the other hand, the other option, I think, is open as well. On the whole, I think it is a culturally impoverishing option, in my opinion, and therefore I would not opt for it. But I would not want to pretend that, in fact, the technology that we can generate does not make that option possible. For one thing, it's my feeling that American energy independence is a very illusory objective, because even if we became energy independent or energy self-sufficient, if there were a major cutoff of oil supplies, most of our friends in the world, including the Japanese and the Europeans, could never hope to aspire to that degree of independence. And I would certainly, for one, hope that if such an event occurred, America would share its resources with its friends and not draw in on itself. Certainly that's the policy that's implicit in the International Energy Agency, the energy sharing thing, and so on. And I believe that's the way we should be going.
Doesn't that suggest that there is an imperative that comes pretty much from the technical economic aspects of the problem?
Yes, but to some extent it involves a political and ethical judgment. It's my belief that the developed countries have a particular moral obligation to reduce their dependence on oil and substitute what I would call more capital-intensive sources of energy, including nuclear energy, solar energy, coal, things like oil, shale, and other things, because they can do that. They have the technological capacity and the wealth to do that, and leave the oil for the developing countries that really can't accumulate the capital to use these more energy, these more capital-intensive sources of energy. So I think there's a real moral obligation to use non-fluid sources of energy, or at least non-natural fluid sources of energy.
Mr. Brooks, are you saying, especially in response to the last point, with regard to our obligations toward developing countries, with regard to our obligations toward our allies, that perhaps the major political lesson of the energy problem is that we really have to think of ourselves as a part of humanity, as a part of a larger world system, and that our policy can't really be developed solely in terms of our immediate short-run national interest?
Yes, I think I would completely agree with that, provided you, in fact, qualify the term national interest with the adjective short-run, because I believe that our long-run national interest is, in fact, lies with the world system and with interdependence and with the sharing of resources with the rest of the world.
You feel it's in our political interest as well as our moral interest to do that?
Yes, I do. Because I think the world is now sufficiently interconnected so that, in fact, our national interest is impacted by political chaos and social disintegration in the rest of the world.
Harvey Brooks is a professor of technology and public policy at Harvard University. Sanford Lakoff teaches political science at the University of California at San Diego. John Agresto is project director at the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with Soundings. The American poet Robert Frost once referred to the shape a poem makes. Figuring out poetic shapes has long intrigued students and critics of language and poetry. For example, Andrew DeBicke is a scholar at the National Humanities Center who's working on a book about modern Spanish poetry and poets.
Well, these poets are writing in seemingly everyday language. They're using a lot of narrative devices and techniques. Many of them of their poems seem to be just descriptions of scenes or tellings of stories. And I found that just trying to analyze an imagery pattern doesn't usually reveal what a poem is all about. I'll give you an example. There's a poem by a poet called Claudio Rodriguez, which describes a man's happiness at having his shirt be cleaned and the fact that that shirt doesn't have to be thrown away, he can use it again. And it's filled with references to laundries and local city places. A student of mine tried to explain that poem by seeing it as a kind of allegory, where the cleaning of the shirt stands for purification. That makes a certain degree of sense, but it makes the poem sort of ludicrous in some ways. I found that in order to get at that poem, I had to take more into account the position of the speaker to read the poem almost as I would read a short story spoken by a very specific narrator, and then to look at the kind of language he used. Then I found that, in essence, the speaker himself is constructing a parallel between this process of getting the shirt clean and his search for some kind of pure vision of things, and that there is an interplay between these two going on. And the real subject of the poem is the interplay, the way the speaker fuses them in his mind, the way he sees a certain humor in this. He sort of pokes fun at himself for making that comparison. And that attention to both the speaker and to the levels of language and to the humor and the way it plays off these two levels against each other really let the poem emerge much better and be understood much better than simply saying, aha, cleaning that shirt is an allegory for finding cleanliness in life. Mm-hmm. To back off a little bit, usually, say, when students read poetry in high school, they will be asked what the kind of message the poem conveys or be asked to repeat the plot so that everyone is sure that they have read the poem and that they know what actually that poem says. But very often when you read a poem that way, when you limit it to a philosophic statement, or maybe when you set it in a historical context, you don't see how the selection of words, of images in a poem, actually gives a meaning, actually makes a new meaning emerge. Now, the poetry that I'm dealing with now, it's more superficially accessible. You do not have trouble understanding what it's about. The bigger problem comes in figuring out what it communicates to you and not reducing it. You know, not reducing this thing by Rodriguez to, oh, well, he just went to a laundry and he's telling us about it. What you try to do is evoke, get the students to present their reactions and then test those against the text to see if those reactions are really produced by something in the poem. That's why when I teach an introduction course, I usually will take one poem, maybe sonnet or even a shorter poem, for one whole day. I'll begin by asking somebody how they reacted to a given line or a given stanza. When I have a reaction, then I say, all right, can you prove to me that that reaction was caused by something in that poem? The touchstone has to be in the poetry, and then the reader reactions have to be caused by the poem. We have to sort of isolate out reader reactions that are simply brought into the poem from the outside. To give you an example, that Claudio Rodriguez poem I was talking about seems to accept the fact that the speaker of the poem, whoever he may be, is talking to someone who's familiar with Madrid, is familiar with laundries and shirts, and also has in the back of his mind some concept of cleanliness as linked to goodness and purity. We could say that by looking at that poem, we can decide that anybody reading the poem should share with other readers these premises. Whether consciously or subconsciously, obviously there's some sort of experience there that's to be created and conveyed. But apart from the intention, I think there has to be in each poem some sort of core. There has to be some basis on which all readers will agree. Now, I know that there are some critics now who are saying, no, that isn't necessarily true. Your deconstructivists are claiming that, in a sense, good works of literature keep on unfolding themselves and contradicting themselves and contradicting their meaning, and that their meaning changes all the time. I tend to think that, finally, there has to be at least some basis of agreement. Mm-hmm. I don't think it extends to every aspect of a poem, but I think if the work doesn't have it, if there is practically no agreement on its effects and its meaning, then there's something suspect about the work. Maybe that work just didn't do it.
Andrew Dubicki teaches at the University of Kansas and is a scholar at the National Humanities Center. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. At the time of his death in the spring of 1981, Charles Davis was head of the Afro-American Studies program at Yale University. Professor Davis was a frequent visitor at the National Humanities Center, where he served on the Board of Trustees. During one of his visits to the center, Charles Davis offered this comment on the phenomenon of Black English.
Black English obviously is a kind of dialect from formal English. It's developed by blacks in the city. It has no connection, obviously, with the kind of, or very little connection with the kind of language which is spoken in the country. Mm-hmm. But it remains, it seems to me, a dialect which depends upon formal English, ultimately. And so, though it's certainly useful to know it and to understand that some people grow up speaking it, as some people grow up speaking, you know, Italian-American or Polish-American or something else like that, but it seems to me highly questionable to give it legitimacy. When I say legitimacy, it seems to be perfectly justified to write in it, as Dunbar, for example, wrote in most effectively and beautifully in dialect, as many of the Irish writers did, you know, as a part of the Irish Renaissance, particularly Synge and O'Casey. So it remains, it seems to me, a language which is rich, but derivative, and it becomes richer if one knows the formal language from which it derives, from which it represents a kind of deviation. And those people who insist upon separation, suggesting that it has indeed a kind of life of its own, a development of its own, seem to me to be wrong.
Charles Davis, who died in the spring of 1981, was head of the Afro-American Studies program at Yale University.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to listen for Soundings. Topics this week include energy and American cultural values, contemporary Spanish poetry and poets, and the phenomenon of Black English, with experts from Harvard and Yale and the University of Kansas. Please join me this week for Soundings.